I'm Courtney Perry. I'm going to be talking to you about copyrights today. This is kind of a copyright basics class. Obviously, I normally teach. I'm an adjunct at Emory Law School, and I will try not to treat you like law students because I kind of like to make them cry. I'll try to be more pleasant to you guys. What I'm going to do today is start out with a few basics so that we all kind of are on the same page and know what we're talking about. I know a lot of y'all have some questions, either kind of general or specific, or as I talk, you'll probably have even more. But let me get through kind of the first little bit so we all kind of know the same thing. I know from experience this will save me having to go back and answer the same question 3 or 4 times. So we're going to do a little bit of basics, and then if you've got some questions, I'm happy to take them at any point during the talk. And we've got a microphone in the back. Our favorite man with the mic will come help you out to ask your question so everyone can hear you and so the fine folks who are recording this will get it too. Yeah. It's much more interesting listening to answers if you heard the question. Although I can answer much better if you don't know what the question was. I can be a politician and answer the question I wish you had asked because I knew the answer to it. But I guess we'll go ahead and use the mic like they tell me to. Okay. Basics of copyright, what it is and what it isn't. There are 3 main forms of intellectual property: copyright, trademark, and patent. They are all very distinct. People get them confused sometimes, which is fine. Y'all don't have to be lawyers. There are enough of us doing it. Copyright, we're going to spend most of the day talking about, so we're going to start with a brief overview of the other two. Trademark, most of y'all are familiar with, consciously or otherwise. Well, look, here's one. And it's the non-local one. I'm in kind of trouble for carrying this around rather than an orange can. This says Mountain Dew. What we know by that is that the green liquid in here is high in caffeine. That's why I have it. But when you look at the label, it tells you what it is and the source of it, and you as a consumer can be certain that's what it is. Simple enough. Trademark, people think about it as an intellectual property because, boy, the folks at Coca-Cola and Walt Disney and other places will protect their intellectual property like it's their last living breath, which it often is. But the law is really not to protect Coke's money. The law is to protect you, the consumers. So when you pick up a red can with a white swoosh, you know what you're getting and you know where you're getting it from. It's not someone else's weird stuff in a can. It's the weird stuff in a can you expect. If you pick up something, God help you, that says Red Bull, you know what you're getting. You're doing it on purpose. But you're getting what you expect. And that's what trademark law is all about. You get what you expect out of what you purchase. You don't have to go research the source every time you buy it. It's not like having to make sure that the serial number on the eggs is not the salmonella kind. You don't have to do that for every purchase you make because of trademark law. Caffeine. But so, yeah. No, I get in trouble if I plug anything because it's not Coke and we live in Atlanta. And, you know, the cameras are on me now. I'm suspect because I'm drinking the other product. When I teach at Emory, I have to, like, put that in a secondary container.
Okay.
So, trademarks, it's names, it's logos, it's labels, it's pictures. It can be trade dress. It can be what the product looks like. Color sometimes can count, and it depends on a whole lot of things. It's not a trademark class. We won't go into all of those details. But the idea of trademark is it identifies the source and the product for the purpose of protecting the consumer so that they're not confused. Okay, I have not yet found a way to protect myself from being confused, but at least I know which soda I'm drinking. And that's the purpose of it. There's federal and state trademark law. If you want to protect your company name, if you want to protect your company logo, if you want to protect the label on your product, you trademark it. It is best to go ahead and go through the trademark process, file it, you get states' rights, which are common law rights, which are narrower. If you just use it, you do have some rights if you start using a product. If it's a company you feel strongly about that you're actually trying to make a living with, go ahead and register the silly thing. It's a couple $100, $320, I think, for a registration. You can do it without a lawyer. It's a little bit annoying. You'll beat your head against the wall a few times. If you do try to file a trademark on your own, like I said, you can do it. It's not that hard. Most lawyers who you hire charge you way too much for it. And do not even think about going on the internet and paying one of these companies $1,000 to do a clearance search and stuff like that. Now that's crap. They Google your name. I mean, come on. Y'all can do that and see if someone else is using it. You can do an initial search of the trademark office yourself also. Don't be paying LegalZoom for this shit. You don't need to. Go on to the trademark website. It's USPTO.gov. It's US Patent Trademark Office. USPTO.gov. Search database. I mean, y'all can do this. We've all been doing it for years. It's not hard. You don't have to pay a lawyer to do it. And I wouldn't if I were you, unless you want to pay me, in which case I'll happily take your money. So you can do your trademark registration. Not that hard. A little bit annoying. You'll go through some confusion. There is a 1-800 number that is hidden, of course, like they always are now, at the bottom of the website. Those are some attorneys who will not advise you on how to do your filing or what you should file or any of those things, but to the extent you have an actual question about filling out the forms, and the forms are all online, they're the employees of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, their trademark research assistants, they will help you, and they're actually really helpful. You can call them with, I'm trying to fill this out and I'm really confused, where can I find information on this, and they'll help you. I would recommend that rather than hiring a lawyer and paying them tons and tons of money, because most of them overcharge you so much for this. And do a Google search. See if someone else is using your name. Search the trademark database. If it doesn't come up, go ahead. File it. That would be my recommendation. Patents are the next one. For this, you will not just need a lawyer, you will need a special lawyer. Patent lawyers are a different breed altogether. As a general rule, if you want to tell a lawyer a joke, there are a few of them that always make us either cringe or laugh or both. The basic one is there are only three lawyer jokes. The rest are true stories. Beyond that, when I have my law students in a room, sometimes I have them actually do something that involves math, and they kind of break out into a cold sweat, because the basic understanding is if any of us could do math or science, we'd be doctors. And if you say that to lawyers, they look away. And they're really sad. Because it's true. We just weren't quite smart enough to do that. So, but there is this little narrow subspecies of people who can do both science and law. Now, most of y'all are probably more familiar with the scientists and the engineers of the world. Most engineers are not who you want to call if you need something written in English. I'm just saying. They're really good with a lot of things and writing lots of words in a row that mean something to other people isn't their strength. Now, we can't do any of that hard science stuff. We're just really good with words and bullshit. There's a very small subspecies of human who can do both, who can handle the hard science and made it through law school. We call them patent lawyers, and we pay them lots of money because they scare us. Now, if you want to file a patent, you need an honest-to-God patent lawyer. It is the only area of law where there is a separate bar exam. They pass the same one all of us do, and then their own. They have to have taken, like, science in college, beyond the astronomy class that I took to get past my science requirement. And they take real hard science stuff. And then they pass the patent bar, which, oh my God, frightens me to even think about. If you are hiring an attorney to file a patent for you, make sure they're a member of the patent bar. Some lawyers will start to file a patent for you. There are things that that regular lawyers can do and things that they can't with respect to filing patents and prosecuting in front of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. I would never, whether it's one of the things we're allowed to do or not, use anyone who's not a patent lawyer to do patent law. Yeah?
I am a patent lawyer. I wanted to just say, depending on the technology, you do not need a lawyer to file your patent. Like you said with the trademark office, the patent office is very helpful. You can call them, and if it's fairly simple, say, how do I do the form? How much do I owe? Because really, you can write your own description of the matter. Writing the claims may be a little trickier, but it can be done if it's simple enough. And also, you don't need a patent lawyer. You need a patent agent. A patent agent is someone who has passed the patent bar, but is not necessarily a lawyer. They charge a lot less money. They can do the exact same job of filing and prosecuting the patent. The lawyers only really need them if you're litigating your patent. So that's all I said.
I have found it's better practice to use a real honest-to-God patent lawyer. That's just been my experience. Some of the folks who have part of the credentials are not generally as good. There are exceptions, of course. There's some patent lawyers who are a bunch of morons. There's some patent agents who are very good at what they do. I have had better luck sending people to folks with both credentials. And with respect to filing your own patent, again, if it's something simple, okay. Most times people are filing patents, it's something important to them. Patents are expensive and difficult. How the claims are drafted is very, very technical. And you're gonna probably screw it up on your own. And if it's something that's going to be important to you downstream, it's worth the investment up front. What I skipped was jumping into patents in general. Most people have the general understanding patents are science. Okay. That's usually enough for most lawyers to go, ooh, science, and step away slowly. Patents are inventions, they're machines, they're processes. It is a very high standard, in theory, to get a patent. It's supposed to be a very high standard. I don't know what is in the water at the patent office right now, but they're drinking something very strange because patents are issuing now that should never have issued. Some of y'all are familiar with some of these stupidpatent.com sorts of sites. There is, honest to God, and I have not memorized the number, a United States patent issued for a method of swinging sideways on a swing.
Yes.
Like on a playground, instead of going forward and back on a swing, the renegades said, ha ha, and go this way and start attacking the kid next to them. Yeah, the teachers won't let you do it for long, but someone patented it.
Overstatement.
It's ridiculous. Patents are issuing, let me get through the first intro step, please. Patents are issuing on crap that should never have issued, and don't even get me started on business method patents. But assuming that you're talking about real science, the standards are supposed to be high, usefulness, non-obviousness, novelty, it needs to be a new invention, it needs to be something that wasn't, duh, obvious, and it needs to be something that's at least on some level useful. Okay. Whole reams of stuff can be said about patents. It's not what we're talking about today. But if you're thinking about protecting an invention, a process, a machine, software can sometimes qualify for patents. We'll talk about software patents and copyright a little bit if we have time to get there, but some software will qualify for patent status. There are issues. There are always issues. But so those are your basic differences. Patent gives you the best protection. If you patent a process of swinging sideways on a swing, hypothetically, not only do you now own the right to sell people that process, but you can keep anyone else in the country from doing it, whether they saw your patent to get the idea or not. If someone else, independently on a playground, invented the idea of swinging sideways on the swing, should you wish to, you could keep them from doing it if you hold a valid patent. That is not like trademark and that is not like copyright. So patent gives you the broadest protection, but it's the highest standards and it's a pain in the butt to get all the way through the process. Okay, those two are what copyright isn't. This is what copyright is. Copyright is intended to give a limited monopoly to artists and authors under the statute. We tend to call all of them authors. So if I refer to author, it covers sculptors, musicians, artists, everyone in there who's creating something copyrightable. We just call them authors. The copyrighted work is what we call it too, because art sounds too much like fun, so we're lawyers, we call it work. But that's the piece of work, the piece of art, the piece of music, the book, the poem, the drawing, whatever. That would be the work. So if I refer to authors and works, that's what I mean. We're lawyers, we like to make our own little language. We haven't copyrighted it though. We just make it obscure so no one wants to learn it. Now, copyright is easy. If you write it down, you're protected by federal law. I have someone here, I'm gonna steal this from you, taking notes at the front of the class. You know what? She has more rights to, oh wait, we're being recorded. Ha ha, I do have copyright in my speech because I am being fixed in a tangible medium as we go. If I had written notes down, those notes would be protected by copyright just by virtue of me writing it down. She wrote some stuff down. She has a copyright in whatever it was she wrote down there. I'm sure it was something brilliant because I said it. I hope that was from my speech, not yes. From the last panel. Okay.
This is my first panel.
Mine too. Okay, so copyright's easy. Write it down, fix it in a tangible medium. That includes your computer's memory. Fix it in a tangible medium, and boom, you're covered by federal copyright. If it's something you care about, file it. If you've written a book, if you've written a poem, if you've written a song, if you've created some really cool piece of art that you actually care about and want to protect, file the copyright. It's easy. It's, I think, $35. This is the easiest of them. You surely don't need a lawyer for this. You pretty much just file out your name and your contact information and the name of your work. And depending on the type of work it is, you either send in like pictures of it or you send in two hard copies of it. Kate, again, there's help numbers and all that stuff. This is actually through the Library of Congress site. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office issues, as you might anticipate, patents and trademarks. Copyright's done through the Library of Congress. It's all online. It's all very, very simple. go ahead and register your copyright for something you care about. Now, there are two things that have never made sense to me. One of them I learned in a first aid class where they told us not to put butter on a burn. I sat back and said, why would you tell me not to do that? And why didn't you mention ketchup and other condiments? What the hell are you talking about? The other thing that I didn't understand at first was when they tell you don't bother mailing something to yourself. Apparently, many people believe that it's good for you, that it's good for a burn to put butter on it, which is why the Red Cross specified don't put butter but didn't mention mayonnaise or salt. But the copyrights people have this understanding that if they put it in an envelope and mail it to themselves, they're protected. No, not at all. In theory, I guess, if you have that sealed envelope with the date stamp on it from the post office and you ended up downstream in some litigation and you still had that sealed envelope and you could convince a judge that you weren't just making this crap up, the judge could, in theory, I think this is why people do it, open the envelope and say, oh, look, there's your original work. You did too have it written on this day. No. File it. That's why we have filing. If it's that important to you, file it. Wait till you're done. You don't have to file every page. You know, if you're writing the Great American Novel, wait till you're done with the Great American Novel. If you're writing some poems, you can file each one, or you can wait till you've got several to put together and file them. But the filing's easy, and don't waste the stamp mailing it to yourself. There's absolutely no legal credence to that. Yeah?
I just wanted to make sure everybody did. They might know the phrase that you were just speaking of. It's called an old man's copyright. That's what the term is used to send to yourself. So just in case anybody didn't know the layman's term for that.
Okay, yeah. No validity whatsoever. Don't do that. Don't put butter on your burn. That's just gross. And don't put your copyright material in the mail to yourself thinking you're doing anything good. If you want to mail it to yourself, go ahead. You're not actually doing any harm, but you're not protecting your copyright. Now, your copyright is valid, like I said, once you fix it. You might want to do a little more than that. Okay, what is copyrightable subject matter? Books, that's the obvious one. Anything you write, anything you create, anything you sing, all of these things count if they're fixed in a tangible medium. Now, they're recording me, so my speech is being fixed in a tangible medium. So I actually have a copyright on my speech, woohoo, or y'all do, I don't know. We can arm wrestle over it. I didn't sign anything. So someone has a copyright in this speech. If they weren't recording it, I'm just speaking, I got nothing. So it has to be fixed, and it has to be original, which is to say I can't have copied it from someone else. Unlike a patent, if someone else has said these exact same words, that would just be strange. But if someone else had said these exact same words, I can still get a copyright in mine, because I assure you I'm not copying someone else in what I'm saying right now. This is originating with me, and that's sufficient originality. In patent, the standard is higher. It has not to be original, but it has to be kind of unique. It has to be novel. No one else can have done it before. They do a search of prior art to make sure that no one else has done this before. Copyright, nah, it's not that hard. As long as you made it up yourself, it counts. There's supposed to be this small level of creativity involved. Pretty much anything beyond alphabetizing last names is creative enough. The judges are not art critics. They will not go in and say, oh, well, that's really pedestrian. We're not going to copyright that. Boring, pedestrian, bad, all of those are fine. There's no quality standard in copyright, just an originality standard, and it's very low. Fix it. Register it, because it's better. You have much better protection. It's not required, but register it. So books, songs count if they're written down. You can have a copyright in a performance of a song. We call them phono records. Honest to God, we still do. The legal term is still phono records for a recording of music. That's a copy of a musical performance. It's called a phono record. We still have case law about piano rolls, too, and they're still binding. So lawyers adapt to change slowly. We don't like it. It frightens us. So we still talk about phono records and copies. We talk about things along those lines. The recording industry, you may have noticed, adapted very slowly and badly to change also. Copyright is intended to protect music. Y'all know you're not supposed to burn DVD or CDs without permission, all those things. Y'all do it anyway. And the recording industry is recently realizing that digital technology is scary for them. Because you used to be protected, just one second, I'm looking. The recording industry originally was protected just by the limitations of technology. if any of y'all are old enough to remember having bootleg Grateful Dead tapes, you know, you knew which generation your tape was, because each time you recorded from a recording, if you had the cool direct ones where you weren't just putting two tape recorders playing into each other's speakers, if you had the direct wired high cool setup, there is still derogation. Each generation of tape, they got worse and worse. Well, then they invented this cool shit called digital technology. And as they tell me, it's all ones and zeros, so there is no lessening of quality with each generation, which means I can copy my Ricky Martin disc as many times as I want, and the last one is just as good as the first one. The recording industry figured that out eventually, and they got very, very sad. Now, you had a question relating to this somehow.
Yeah, you mentioned that patents cannot be copied, but you can't have more than one patent between people, but copyright can be, and you've got prior art there. What happens when copyright and patents come into conflict there, but the copyright is actually prior art to the patent?
If the patent has issued and is valid, then it wins. I'm not quite sure I follow your question.
When they issue the patent, what happens if there's a copyright for something, because the copyright's the lesser level, but it already exists as prior art, and then the patent is issued?
I guess with software, that might happen. An invention does not have to be patented to count as prior art in a patent search. So if you're, when you're applying for your patent, the patent examiner will look into the prior art, and that's not just patented items. So if something is out there that for some reason is protected by copyright rather than patent, if it's out in public use, it would be counted as part of prior art, and it could keep the patent from issuing. Is that what you meant?
Yes, to a large degree, because I know that especially in software, there's a lot of things that are being patented that everyone's going, but that already exists, and they issued a patent.
Patents in software and copyrights, what should be happening isn't.
Thanks.
There are a lot of ways it's supposed to work, and if you're using patent and copyright and software all in the same sentence, you just got to do this every now and again. Yeah.
When getting your copyright, does properly attributed quote pass?
There's a huge distinction which a lot of people don't understand. Again, not being lawyers, it's fine.
Former paralegal.
If my law students get it wrong on their exam, they get trouble, but real people are allowed to. There's a distinct difference between plagiarism and infringement. Plagiarism is when I write down someone else's ideas, someone else's research, someone else's work, and claim it for my own. Especially in the academic world where I've been living recently, that's really bad. That's lying, cheating, and stealing all rolled into one, and you know, you can even lose tenure over that. But that's plagiarism, and that's cured by attribution. Oh, I have this clever thing to say. I got it from this guy. I have these clever things to say. I got it from these people. I have this really unique thing to say, but since I'm a lawyer, I want to cite it to something. So here's these little things that I can cite it to also. No worries there. That attribution cures plagiarism. Attribution doesn't cure copyright infringement. If I hold a copyright, and I'm about to get to the exclusive rights, I have some rights in my work. Not all the rights in the world, but the rights given to me by the statute. I have the right to keep you from copying it. I have the right to keep you from altering it. So people who want to do derivative works by sampling my song, people who want to take my art and digitalize it and, I don't know, make it into an Obama campaign poster, they're not allowed to do that stuff. I have the right to keep them from doing that. And if they attribute it to me, that doesn't keep them from having infringed my copyright, and I can still sue them. And I'm not a litigator, but it makes litigators very happy when we say things like, and then I can sue them. but if you infringe my copyright, I can sue you and I can win. I mean, I can sue anyone. The question is, can I also win? But if you have infringed my copyright saying, oh yeah, I stole it from her, that doesn't save the fact that you stole it. You know, if you steal my car, telling the cop, oh yeah, I stole it from this chick back on the corner, doesn't keep you out of jail. Attribution does not save you from copyright infringement. Now, there are a lot of folks who will release their goods out sort of into the public work, or public their works into the public domain. Some of y'all are familiar with the Creative Commons. It's actually one of the few things that I will tell you can get off the internet that's legal, that's worth anything. Lawrence Lessig kind of started this group off. They have a number of licenses you can use, and he's an actual law professor. He knows some shit. As a general rule, if you can download the form off the internet, don't bother. They're all crap. Even stuff you pay for, I mean, I guess it's as good as what you'd buy at Home Depot in the will section, but sometimes liquid plumber works, sometimes you need a real plumber. Most of those forms that you can buy only work if your sink's only sort of a little bit clogged. But with respect to most licenses you would get, if you're trying to actually license your work in a meaningful way, you need a lawyer who can work through an agreement that will specifically tailor the terms of what you're trying to do. However, if you have created a piece of cartoon art that you want people to see, you would love them to copy it and use it in their own stuff, you would love to see a stylized version of that become an Obama campaign poster, an easy way to accomplish that is to use the Creative Commons license. Because a lot of folks, it's not so much about protecting all of their rights, it's just making sure, for instance, that their work is attributed. There is a Creative Commons license that specifically is an attribution-only license. You release it out with this and with the little Creative Commons work numbers and words on it, and it says, hey, use my stuff however you want, just tell people where you got it. For a lot of artists and authors, that makes a lot of sense. A lot of musicians really want you to download their stuff off their website and play it and share it with your friends, because that's how they're going to actually get to make a living someday. A lot of authors who have, like, honest to God publishing deals with real publishers will still put out their books on the web for free because they have discovered, and some of them believe this and some don't, that if they put the shit out there for free, people will actually still buy it.
Vane Publishing
is the big one. They have Eric Flint, real authors. John Ringo's doing it too. You can get their stuff free on the Vane site. It's really kind of cool. And you know what? People are still buying their books. Lawrence Lessig puts all of his stuff out for free on the internet, and you know what? I still buy his stuff. But I mean, I teach from it. But I feel guilty if I'm getting it for free. I'm like, for God's sake, I'm using it, I'm citing it. I should buy the man's book. And apparently, it kind of works that way. I signed one of his books last semester in one of my classes and told the students, hey, look, go to the site. Here it is. It's free. You're allowed to do it. We're not violating any copyrights. You're not doing anything illegal. The man lets you do this. And about half of them still bought the book. So there's a marketing theory in there that give it away for free and people will still buy it. Not everyone is on board with that, but if you're one of them who is, you can release it under a Creative Commons license. You're abrogating a lot of your copyright rights, but in some cases it's what people want. This is a really cool kind of grassroots movement that said, well, rather than trying to get Congress to change something, although they try that too, but in the meantime they can do something that will work, and that's create a product people can use easily. And you can trust the Creative Commons license. Like I said, normally I would tell you don't trust shit you can get off the internet that's legal. The Creative Commons license you can. It's good and it's solid. You have a question?
Yeah, in the case of like a web comic, mm-hmm. where you have a specific character that's really important to it, the story, mm-hmm. would you copyright the whole comic or just the character or both?
Both is your answer. Characters are protected under copyright. But, well, there's actually a fairly recent case with a very good litigator here in town that sort of destroyed that to an extent. But characters in general are copyrightable. And to an extent, your copyright on your character is going to depend on how well you define that character. If it is a very unique character, then that very unique character and the unique aspects of it, you would have rights to keep someone else from using that character. You cannot keep people from using a superhero in a cape. Yeah, you're still not protected yet. You need to get more and more detailed. By the time you get detailed to a superhero who's reliant on gadgets rather than any particular radioactive bite from some animal, and whose parents were killed out in front of a movie theater, and who's dark and brooding and goes through sidekicks and tights and drives a really cool car and lives in a cave and is really rich and has a British butler, at some point you've gotten detailed enough that you can keep someone else from using that character. But until you get detailed enough that you're not taking, for instance, star-crossed lovers out of the public domain, then you can be protected. But you know, Romeo and Juliet, most of y'all are familiar with. West Side Story, awfully darn similar. And, I mean, okay, Shakespeare was not copyrighted by the time they wrote West Side Story. Even if Shakespeare had still been under current copyright at the time West Side Story came out, it would have been okay. You don't get to own the copyright in boy meets girl, boy and girl fall in love, things go badly. You can't own that. But by the time you write it out into increasing levels of detail, there's something there you own. Now, technically, copyright applies only to the expression of your idea. This is important. There's expression, there's idea. My idea is boy meets girl, boy falls in love with girl, things go badly. That idea is not protectable. How I tell that story, the actual words I use, that can be protected. Again, it has to be original enough, but it's protected against more than just verbatim copying. So if I write the boy meets girl story, no one can copy my words and slap their name on it. That's easy. But when someone else writes the boy meets girl story, how much can they tell of my story? Well, you know, I'm not the first one who wrote that. I'm betting it's been done at least two or three times before. So there's probably a certain amount of public domain basic story elements there that are never going to be mine, no matter how well I tell the story. So the line between my expression and my idea is where my copyright starts and ends. This is relevant, one sec. This is relevant when you start trying to copyright books that have facts in them. If I write a history book and I discover where Arthur is actually buried, I can prove he's not just a legend, I found him and there was a really cool cup buried with him. You know, I can prove this because I dug around in lots of parts of England, I interviewed a lot of people who seemed to know shit, they had British accents, they must be smart. I've gone through an awful lot of original research, I have worked myself stupid. Here's the ultimate research book that I have created. You know what? Any one of you could read my book and say, cool, and write your own version of those exact same historical facts that I'm putting out. And as long as you don't copy my words, and arguably if I arrange my book in an original idea, in some original way, you can't have copied my book, but you can freely take the facts and the ideas out of my book and use them because they are not protected by copyright. Now, the difference between copyright and patent. In patent, the substance is what it's all about. It's not about the form, it's about the substance. In copyright, it's all about the form. The substance is not protected by copyright. The first case that all of us learn in law school for copyright law is Baker v. Selden. None of y'all care about Baker v. Selden. You don't have to memorize this. It will be on the exam, but y'all won't be here for it, so it's fine. It was the man who actually invented dual column accounting. Yeah, because before, just thinking about it, someone wrote a book on it, someone else said, huh, that's pretty clever, and wrote a successful book on it. The first book made no money, the second book made scads of money. The second book just blatantly copied the accounting forms that were in the back of the first book. And the court said, you know, you didn't copy the words, you didn't copy the expression, you copied the idea, you're allowed to copy the idea, and you couldn't use that idea without those forms, so those forms are part of the idea. Even though they were an expression, they were written out forms, those became part of the idea because without those forms, you couldn't use the idea. Copyright will not protect the idea. Anything underlying that's meaningful is not protected, and part of your expression can end up being attached to that form, to that substance, so, and not protected also. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, we have someone next.
Two questions.
Yeah.
If you go to Google patent search, you can look up technology on anti-gravity. They say it's not possible, but there's a patent on it. So can you patent stuff that isn't real? And the second question
is... In theory, no.
So it's technically real then? They're just not telling you?
I don't get the same Kool-Aid packets that the patent office gets, so right. I don't know.
Okay. Second one is I have an old technical reference on some old phonograph stuff. Mm-hmm. The guy got it from the company who made it, and he wrote it into a book. Okay. Can you freely copy the information, saying it has a number two spring or an XYZ motor or whatever?
Yes.
And you can put that in your own database?
Yes.
And give it out for free?
The information... The substance, the good stuff, the information, the facts, the theories, the text of a, not the text, but the underlying fact, the underlying ideas are not protected by copyright.
Can you do it word by word?
No, that's copy.
You just have to change, you have to say it's a number two spring or whatever, not give the name of it.
Okay, now this is where it's going to be the traditional answer of it depends. You may take the facts freely. If there's really only one way to describe it by saying, this engine uses a number 15 spring. Well, the fact that he also said this engine uses a number 15 spring does not mean you can't say this engine uses a number 15 spring, because you'd be hard pressed to figure out how else to say that. A number 15 spring is used by this engine. You don't have to do that. If what they have said is really the only way to say it, or the easy, you know, the most direct way to say it, you don't have to change two words and invert the subject and verb and make everything passive and say, there, I didn't infringe his copyright. Recipes are an example of this. Recipes are technically copyrightable. They're expression. I write down how to make my cookies or whatever. Well, the underlying process of making chocolate chip cookies is not protectable by copyright. Me writing down my recipe kind of sort of is. A recipe book, a cookbook, ends up being protectable because I have chosen and selected different recipes out of all the recipes in the world, which now you can buy your computer. And so you can select the recipes, arrange them how you want them, put attractive photos next to them. That compilation, that cookbook, is yours. You can't own a copyright in how to make the cookies. And chances are, unless you have a very interesting way of putting it in, I don't know, Dr. Seuss verse, you are not going to own the directions to make the cookies. That's a process. You could patent it, perhaps, but you can't get a copyright in add 2 cups of sugar, blend well, heat. You know, things like apply, lather, rinse, repeat, you don't get to copyright that, but you can copyright the rest of the text of your label, maybe. So, to an extent, if you're just writing the basic technical specs of whatever these machines are you were talking about, probably you can use the direct words they use if it's, you know, this engine uses this spring, this engine uses this spring. But you can't copy their expression wholesale.
You just have to make it look different but have the same data.
The data is not protected, the expression is.
So if you copy paste.
It depends. I don't know exactly what you're talking about. I'm not going to give you bad legal advice.
Yeah.
Probably, but it depends on the specifics. But the bottom line is that data is not protected. Their expression probably is, although you said it's a really old one. It may be in the public domain anyway.
Yeah, it's like 90 years old. So.
90 years old, it probably is no longer protected. At 90 years old, it is probably no longer protected, but it still technically could be, depending on when it was copyrighted and whether they renewed it. You had something you've been waiting to ask me.
Yeah, I think you said it like with Avatar and Pocahontas, that's fine, isn't it?
I have no idea what you're asking. I could answer that. Avatar and Pocahontas are fine. I enjoyed both movies.
No, I mean like the entire story of Avatar is just Pocahontas but space.
Space Pocahontas, I like it.
Avatar is Pocahontas in space.
Huh. Pocahontas is a character. Ferngully dances with wolves.
The story of the evil white man ruins everything good, you don't get to own. Your particular expression of evil white man ruins everything good, you may have protection in. The actual story of Pocahontas, which is not nearly as pretty as Disney made it, and then she died in England. It's a pretty awful story in real life. And Disney made it pretty, and there's music and raccoons. All of which are protected. And boy, if you're going to try to steal something, don't steal it from Disney. They will hunt you down and kill you. The ultimate, like, cage match, in my mind, would be the Disney lawyers and the Coca-Cola lawyers. I want to watch that because I'm thinking it's just going to be blood as far as the eyes can see and no one's coming out of the cage. So if you're going to mess with someone, don't mess with the mouse. They will mess you up. Who was next? I have a question. Okay, yeah.
In the realm of script writing, you know, when you copyright your work and then you try to shop it to a studio, sometimes they will purchase that work, but they don't necessarily want you in charge of it once they've purchased it. Sometimes they just purchase it from you and then they hand it to someone else sometimes for what's called a rewrite.
Right.
And you had said that with copywriting, you are protected from your work being altered. Now, is that something that when you sign your paperwork with the studio selling it, you give up that right from your copyright?
If you're a firstborn child, you okay. If the studio buys something from you, they will have you sign a document that their lawyers wrote. At that point, you will want to hire a lawyer to read that document so that you understand what you're signing, because although we like to say that our documents are written in plain English, it's this modern trend amongst lawyers, our drafting is intended to be clear and in plain English. Compared to what it used to be, it is. But we think it's clear, but, you know, we're not quite right. So if you actually are looking at a contract with the studio, hire an honest-to-God lawyer, not a litigator. Get a copyright lawyer. Get someone who does transactional work, who deals with contracts. Litigators will tell you they can write a contract. They are lying. They can't write a contract. I mean, I can go into a courtroom. I've done it once. I won. But, you know, I was representing myself against a travel company that screwed me over on a trip to Jamaica, and I was just pissed. I said, well, I'm a lawyer, damn it. And I'm going to, and I wanted a reasonable settlement from them. They told me to go pound sand. I said, I'm a lawyer. Ha 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 ha. I'm going to break out my big letterhead, because I still have a big firm then. I broke out my big company letterhead, and I said, you know, I asked them for a couple comps tickets just to make up for all the crap they put me through. They said, no, I'm going to figure out how much those comp tickets would be worth to them, and I'm going to make sure they pay at least 10 times that much in legal fees to make me go away. And they did.
easier to settle.
It was much more fun. I mean, it's small claims court. I mean, it's not like I was really in court. But so I won my lawsuit. I have 100% success rate in my litigation. Yeah. So do not hire me to prosecute your litigation. I won't do it because I have an actual obligation to my clients of competency, and I would not be. I didn't even do moot court. I talk, I can do that, but I don't do trials. And if someone hired me to do one, I would tell them no. Litigators, for some reason, seem to think they can do my job. I know I can't do theirs. They think they can do mine. They cannot. Do not hire a litigator to read your contract. They will not understand it. They will say they do. They will think they do, but they do not. Hire a transactional attorney, a copyright lawyer who does transactional work, to read that and advise you on it and to tell you what's in it. Now, if you're signing your first contract with a big studio, you can't change anything. There will be things in there where you promise them everything you've ever done. There will be things in there where you promise them your children and your cats. Just sign it or don't, because you can't negotiate with the big studio on your first deal usually. There's an exception to that. Y'all have heard of her. She wrote this book about wizards and schools and stuff. I do not know how that woman got creative control over her screenplay. I want to know what she did, because she is the only time I have ever heard of a first-time author getting any kind of control over the movie version when it sold before her books even hit the bookstores. They bought the book. They bought the movie rights from her before she was successful, and she got creative control, which is great because she saved us all for another Spielberg movie. That's what the studios wanted to do, is make Harry Potter done by Spielberg. It would have been set in the Southern California private school. But she saved from that by saying, not just no, but hell no. And I don't know how she got that, because common sense and everything I've ever learned about this area says she doesn't get any control when she signs that first contract, but she did. Anne Rice didn't. She was way too late. But y'all have heard about that story. Yeah.
Two questions. In context with the parts and pieces of what you're copywriting, is there a test when you're copywriting music that certain you have to have a certain amount of before when a phrase becomes repeated from another piece of music? I'm curious, because it's hard to sometimes get all the notes to come out so that they'd never been done before.
Yeah, talk to George Harrison about it. He had some similar troubles.
Yeah.
Any of y'all have not listened to He's So Fine and My Sweet Lord and think that judges get things right. Mm-hmm. Any rate, there's not a, you know, you must have three original notes in a row rule. Mm-hmm. If you're not copying it from someone, if you're making it up yourself, in theory, it's copyrightable. Now, the George Harrison case is one that goes counter to what the law is supposed to be. They have direct evidence of George Harrison having composed My Sweet Lord. Billy Preston was there. They worked on it together. If this is not direct evidence of independent creation, you will never see direct evidence of independent creation. Mm-hmm. And yet the courts discovered that he had subconsciously infringed the chiffons, He's So Fine, Do Lang, Do Lang, Do Lang. And so with the subconscious infringement, if you're later sued by someone who composed a famous work, they may say your work is too close to theirs, and although you say I wrote it myself, they say, oh, but everyone heard the Macarena, and so clearly since yours is similar in these three riffs, clearly you subconsciously infringed the Macarena. Bad law, but it's the rule now.
Right. And then,
but there's not a rule of thumb of you must have six notes that no one's ever put together before. If you independently create it, it's copyrightable, except for the bad law that came out of the chiffons.
Okay, and then the other part was, copyrighted, can you still take and use the Creative Commons license to share that copyrighted material and get it more broadly spread?
You can always use the Creative Commons license. There are some restrictions within some of the Creative Commons licenses as to what you're doing with your own copyright. But if you can, but basically, if you own all the rights, you can give some of them away.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you can take them back, and sometimes you can't. So that one's kind of an it depends rule. I'm going to let Keith be in charge of my who's next question here.
Okay. The question that I had is, what I have is a web series that I do, and it's basically like superheroes, kind of piggybacking off what she said about the comic books. And there is a lot of characters in, almost over 300, and some of them have their own spinoffs and introduce new characters in that spinoff. Is it true that if it's all under one, what's called Fighting Angels, so if it's under the Fighting Angels name, like, how does that work? Do you have to create a new copyright for every new character that came in that spinoff, but
if
they're still in the same thing?
Copyright for the work, the characters as they appear in the work, if they're sufficiently delineated to be copyrightable, will have the protection as part of that work. It's not like trademark, where each time you put up a new logo, you file a new trademark application for it. The copyright covers all of the elements of your work. But if you file a copyright on the first 15 parts of your series, it does not necessarily cover the later ones. But again, remember, you're covered whether you file or not. So it's going to depend completely on whether all 300 of those characters are sufficiently delineated that you recognize them. Do they, in effect, become the story being told, or are they just players on the field? The old-fashioned, the traditional Irish cop, there are a lot of them. You can go through the Jewish banker, any of a number of now politically incorrect stereotyped characters. You don't get to own those, but if you write out Shakespeare's Shylock, you know, by the time you get to that well-defined character, well, then you've got something. So it's going to depend completely on how well-delineated those characters are. If what you're really trying to protect is the name of your series, as here is this name, and here are these pictures that describe something coming from me, you may actually be lapsing over in something you want to trademark. If you're trying to describe a service or a good in terms of it coming from you, and coming as part of this series, maybe, but not always.
But if it's film, if you had like a film and a comic book and a cartoon, but they're still in the same world, there's just different versions of it, that means you have to copyright the cartoon and the comic and the film?
Each one of them is going to be subject to copyright by virtue of them being fixed. If you really want to protect them, I would go ahead and file each individual work.
Okay.
But remember, you are technically protected just by virtue of having fixed it in the tangible medium. Okay, so we've talked about subject matter, we've talked about, I'm sorry, I have to let him do it with the mic or I'm going to end up pissing people off. So we've talked about subject matter, we've talked about what's covered and what's not. The way that you get it protected is easy. You own certain rights that are given to you by the statute. These are the exclusive rights. It's the right to copy. It's the right to adapt. It's the several others related to that. Performance is a right. You can't perform my poem. You can't adapt my poem. The big one, of course, is you can't copy it. Now, one thing, however, that's an exception to that is what we call the first sale doctrine.
No one has a book anymore.
Yeah, new books. Excuse me. Something to hang on to here.
Here you go.
Excellent, thank you. I have a book. Now, do I own this book? Oh, no. Can he get it back from me?
Yeah.
Okay, we will assume that someone owns this book. Now, assuming this was in fact my book, rather than the one I just stole from someone in the crowd, we'll talk about transfer of title with a, hey, can I have that, and what that means. But most of y'all understand inherently that, assuming this were my book rather than his, I own this book. I can rip it up if I want to. I promise I won't. I can tear it apart, I can stomp on it, I can pitch it in a fire. I can't make it into something else that's important. I can't turn it into art. I can't make a screenplay out of the text in this book. But I own this physical copy of this work. So I can do whatever I want to these dead trees. But the words in there, I do not own. I own a copy of them. I don't own the underlying work. I own a copy. That's the first sale doctrine. Now, I can resell this book. if it were actually mine. I can rent this book out, I can sell it, I can destroy it, I can do whatever I want. Used bookstores are not violating anyone's copyright because I own this book. I don't own the work, I own the book. Is that true of software?
No, you only buy a line.
In software, you're not buying a copy. You're getting a license. And so although you do, maybe, depends on what Bill Gates says this week, own the actual disk on which you bought the software, you have no first sale rights to that copy. Because you have not purchased a copy, you have gotten a license to use. I agree. In addition to agreeing to become Bill Gates' towel boy, you have agreed to all of the terms of that license. By opening the box, if you actually bought the software in a store, you have agreed. It's called a shrink wrap license. By opening the shrink wrap, that piece of paper that fell out, those were the terms you just agreed to. You threw them away. But they're binding. By saying, yeah, I agree, you've just agreed to a whole lot of legally enforceable terms. Goes completely counter to how copyright law is supposed to go, but software is copyrightable. There's a long story there. It's a strange and uncomfortable mix, but in theory, with tangible works that are easy to understand, I own this paper, I do not own the work, the words on it. I cannot go make copies of this. I can destroy it, I can sell it, I can rent it, I cannot copy it, I cannot translate it and make translations of it. I can use it seems to be a book about video games. I could use the information in this book. If I don't care about plagiarism, I can use it without citing the information. But I cannot quote any of the language in here without violating copyright. And again, software, in theory, software would be the same way because it's copyrighted, but it's not. So it's just something to be aware of when you're talking about things that are really supposed to be copyrighted. First sale doctrine applies. Once you own a copy, you can do a lot of things to that copy. You can't make more copies. If you buy a piece of art down in the dealer, or in the art room, in the dealer's room, wherever, if you buy a piece of art, you own that print, right? Well, one thing you can do is hang it on your wall. One thing you probably cannot do is hang it in your movie studio and use it in one of your sets for a movie. If you display that piece of art in your movie, you are violating the performance right attached to that piece of art. Anytime you have someone's copyrighted art, be careful what you do with it, because although you own the tangible piece, you don't own the work. You also can't rip it up and turn it into a collage. That's derivative work, not allowed to do that. The artist is the one who owns the right to do that. So the distinctions are important. And as an artist, as the author, you get to decide who can do those things and who can't. As the purchaser of a copy, you're limited. I have more. Yes?
Yes. I had a quick question about the process of the copyright. I just recently did a copyright on some music. Mm-hmm. And of course, be honest with you, I understand it makes sense. My question is more of more than one person. Of course, you got one or two people, put them on the copyright, but my thing is, as far as performance work, where it involves one person writing it, one person making the music, and one person performing the artistry, how does counting everybody in there go be documented properly? I know when I called the copyright office, they told me that it would just be right for, like, let's say I wrote the song lyrically, I just wrote the song in some type of formal format, copyright that. Somebody wrote the music, copyright that. And then whoever's performing it, okay, I don't know how they told me on that one, but anyway, what do you say about that?
Because that's correct.
Okay, all right. So I just want to make sure, because it just, you know, it just seems repetitive.
There's different, yeah, there's a whole lot of different works there, a whole different rights.
Yeah.
There's the
even though it's one song,
there's
yeah.
The performance of the composition, there's the musical part, but there's the lyrics. There's different elements of that. And once you get into music, you also get into the realm of BMI and ASCAP. And the rules are all different there. For instance, although it's actually in front of Congress now, they're trying to change it. When a song's put on the radio, the artist doesn't get any money. The composer gets money every time a song is played, and it goes through how ASCAP and BMI say they get money, which is just one of those things that we don't get to see. But mystery happens, and then money comes out the other side. But radio stations pay to play music. The performers don't get squat. And that's actually, there's a movement to change that right now, as you might anticipate. The performers all think that'd be really cool. The radio stations all think that would really suck. But that's why also, if you look back at a lot of like Rolling Stones songs and Beatles songs, for instance, they made sure that everybody got writing credits, whether they wrote or not, because that way they got money. If you weren't on that, you don't get money. And she's been waiting forever to talk, so let me go ahead and let you ask me a good question.
I'm a library science student, okay. And we deal a lot with...
Wait, let's get you the mic.
I'm a library science student, and we deal a lot with, visual and textual literacy. And so in our works, we're trying to teach, like what I deal with is comics in libraries.
Okay.
And so in our works, you know, we want to be able to explain to, you know, librarians who don't, or teachers who don't necessarily know the medium that well, what they're all about, and it's really difficult to do that without including images from those works and their copyrighted works. And so, you know, in our presentations, that's one thing, peer-reviewed journals, but when you get into like publishing books about graphic novel collections in libraries, at what point does it stop being fair use and start being infringement?
Depends on how good your litigator is.
Mm.
Fair use is another good topic to get into. That's a good segue. Fair use is when you are allowed to use someone's copyrighted work in spite of the fact that it's a copyrighted work. So I have the protection in my song. You can't use my song, well, unless. Okay, Vanilla Ice did not get to use that cool little riff from Under Pressure.
No, really, mine's different. See, theirs goes dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, and mine goes dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun.
Watch the behind the music, it's hysterical as Vanilla Ice tries to explain the difference between his riff and Queen's. But so you don't get to just use a little piece of it, but fair use says, okay, since your only rights to your work, now this is actually something I didn't touch on yet. In Europe, you own your copyright because you created it. It's like that line out of Mad Max. It's my snake, I trained it, and I'm gonna eat it. I wrote this work, I put in the fruits of my labor, I own this thing. Natural rights, property rights. Sort of like I own this book because I conned out some guy in my audience who didn't realize he was transferring title to me. I own this thing, an intangible intellectual property intuitively and in Europe is that way. I own it because I made it. Not here. In the United States, I own it because the government says I can for a limited period of time. There are no natural law rights to your intellectual property, to your copyright. You only have the rights the government gives you. They're defined in the Copyright Act, they're the ones we've been talking about, and they are limited by what they call a use which is fair. Fair use, which you all have heard about. Fair use used to be a fairly straightforward application of four elements. Litigators got a hold of it. Now, fair use is whatever the litigators say it is. The transforming nature of the publishing industry has actually changed it somewhat, too. It used to be academics was an absolute exemption to copyright. If I'm using it for an educational purpose, all bets are off. I can use it for my purposes. Now, even though that's expressly in the statute, the answer is, yeah, maybe. If it's something that you could have gotten permission to use, you should have gotten permission, is what I'm going to kind of break down as the final rule. There's a whole lot of law behind this, but honestly, if you're going to publish a book, get permission for everything that's in it. Don't rely on fair use because you're going to get hit.
You're going to get no.
Now, when I teach copyright law, I play George Harrison and the Chiffons in my song. I make the students listen to it till their ears bleed. Surprised number of them have never heard either song, much less both songs. And I make them listen to these songs. Now, I actually paid for the songs because I figure if I'm going to make a living in this area, I shouldn't steal shit. So I've paid for both songs, and I can play them freely in my class. That is covered as an academic use. My use is fair. I am not violating anyone's copyright. However, I just finished a textbook, and some of the stuff is going to be online materials, and I can't just post even my honestly purchased MP3 files. I cannot post those on Lexis's website for people to access forever and ever, amen, because that goes beyond the limited classroom use. Fine to play it for my students, not so much putting it up on the website, even though the website would be attached purely to students in classes that have adopted my book. Still beyond the fair use, I would need to get permission from the owners of those two songs. Or I can link it to UCLA that already has them up. Just hypothetically. You can link it to YouTube, but those links come and go so fast it's hard. But there are some academic libraries that have online components, and so I'm linking to UCLA's library that has both of those songs and some underlying documents as well. So just because some uses are fair doesn't mean all uses are fair. What you can do in a classroom, what I could do here today if I had copies with me or I wanted to quote works, I have very broad rights there in terms of fair use. I'm using it for criticism, I'm using it for teaching, satire. Any of those things. I'm sorry, what?
Satire.
Satire counts, that's a whole other ball of wax too. Joe Beck has done more damage to copyright. Brilliant litigator, but God, he's messed up the law. But so for yours, to the extent you're doing it in a classroom, yeah. Quote what you need to, show what you need to up on the screen. If you're printing it into a book, you need to get permission. And even though the law, there's four elements and you have an ad hoc weighing of the elements and on and on and on, I can teach 3 weeks worth of substance, which I do, on fair use. But for your purposes, when you're putting it in a book, get permission.
It's difficult though, because so many of the publishers will just tell you no without even looking at it, and because it's just easier to say no.
Then find something else to use.
Yeah.
Because, and this is one that's hard to accept, but the reality is someone else owns it. And just because you want to use it, doesn't mean you get to. Yes?
I don't know where the mic is, but do we have...
Right here, because I'm not done.
Okay. But he's in charge, so he has to ask.
Yeah, I wondered...
I work for him, so I answer his questions first.
I wonder if you know of any rights clearance centers where you could put in the name of a work or URL or anything like that and just kind of automatically get... go and purchase a payment. You just make a small payment, and then you get a right to use.
It would be cool. For music, yes, there's a compulsory license if you want to do a cover of music. There's a compulsory license to do that, which means you get to and you just get to pay a fixed fee through ASCAP or BMI. So if it's music, you go through ASCAP and BMI, and chances are they will give you the permission to do it. In publishing, no, we're not that easy. Now, the Creative Commons folks keep a nice big database of works released under Creative Commons. The software guys do a better job, I think. But there are some works that are kind of uniformly kept under the Creative Commons license where you can find things that are safe. Unfortunately, there is not a good, you know, copyrightclearance.com where you can go and say, I want to use this much of your book for this much, for this purpose, how much do I owe you? If you're dealing with one of the big publishing houses, yeah, they actually do that pretty well. If you're dealing, especially with some of the academic publishers, they do that all the time. Oh, you want to use this chapter and some course materials? Okay, this is how much it's going to cost your school. So there has become a much more centralized clearinghouse in some areas. And that actual clearinghouse is why some of the academic fair use has been cut away. Because now it's actually very easy for the professors to get permission to use it. And if it's easy to get permission, you damn well should have, and it's no longer fair use because you should have just had your school call their school and money exchanges. But there's not a central, there's not somewhere for real like that I'm aware of that you can just go and say, I want to use this part of your book. You gotta track down the owner. Now, oftentimes, the owners are someone corporate and centralized, which makes it much easier, but not always.
Most of the time.
It depends. Yeah. But I'm not aware of one where that's that easily done, except in music.
I wanted to suggest that Rowling's had a British copyright, which is more extensive
than
ours.
But she signed with the screenplay was with an American film company. So it was all a matter of copyright, not a matter of her, or it's a matter of contract, not copyright at that point. Keith, who am I talking to next?
She did.
Thank you. Once you file a copyright, how long is it good for?
How long is the copyright good for? The copyright is good for the life of the author plus 90 years.
At the moment.
Well, that was just expanded. They're probably not going to do it much further. There's some. Well, there's a whole litigation.
With the growing might behind it, you never know.
Life of the author plus some.
Technically, it's limited.
It is. It's a fixed period. The Supreme Court already told us that it's fine. Yeah, that's limited. The running joke here is copyright is created by the Constitution, and the Constitution says that in order to encourage the production of progress of useful works and art, we are going to allow authors to have a monopoly limited in time over their works. Like I said, it only comes from the law. There's the express grant of power in the Constitution, but it's a limited monopoly. And there has been a big lawsuit recently. The Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act extended it from 70 to 90 years, and the 76 Act originally extended it from two short periods to one life of author and then some period. And the people who want to get at other people's works are really, really pissed because those other people's works that they want to get to keep getting protected a little longer and a little longer. So the people who own those works think, oh, thank God, I still can get some value out of the product that I created, and the people who want to steal it from them have to wait a little longer, and they're getting more and more pissed. And so there was a huge Supreme Court case about that Copyright Extension Act, Eldred v. Ashcroft. And it was, I mean, Lawrence Lessig, who I've mentioned a couple times, is one of the guys on it. One of his more recent books is one of his mea culpas about how he screwed up the strategy and lost the case, because they seem to believe that if it's long, it's equivalent to forever, as opposed to limited, which the Constitution says it has to be. And so depending on which side of the fence you sit on, either the Copyright Extension Act was the most horrible thing ever, or, yeah, whatever.
For the extension, though, does it go to the family?
Yes. There's actually a very detailed way about which heirs and how it's divided out. Lawyers control the solution to that. So yeah, if the author or his heirs. There was you've been waiting. Oh, I'm sorry. She's got the mic.
Hello.
You're next. Oh. Yes.
I'm interested in the use of fair use of video and music on videos and such. I guess on YouTube for a nonprofit.
Just because you're nonprofit doesn't mean your use is fair. You usually have to get permission.
Okay.
There's no blanket exception for nonprofit use, nor is there for churches. They seem to think there is, but there's not.
It was for criticism, satire kind of thing.
If it's legitimately for criticism or satire, you may or may not have a fair use to do it, but people want to be able to use things the law says you can't. And just because you want to, just because your heart is pure, does not mean you get to steal. So the rules are complicated at that point. You can call anything criticism. After the Wind Done Gone case, you can call anything satire, and you might be right. The Wind Done Gone is just the most awful case ever. Joe Beck's a local lawyer who won that case. Brilliant lawyer, bad law. So anything may be satire now after his case.
Weird Al Yankovic gets releases from the whoever he's going to do a parody of. He tries to get releases from all of them. And
because
in one
smart.
Case, in one case, the thing he did, White and Nerdy, there's a thing on there where he says you suck on the webpage, but that was where he had actually gotten permission, done a parody of this guy's work, and then it was all done and produced. The guy said, never mind, no, I don't want you to do that. And so that's what that webpage is about, just a little trivia about copyright.
Yeah, Weird Al is very smart and very successful. He gets permission when he can, because that way he doesn't have to pay a bunch of lawyers to prove that his thing was satire. And some of his are and some of his aren't. Because satire is not just, I want to use your catchy tune because then people will notice what I'm doing better. People will pay more attention to mine if it sounds like your song, and my song is about something completely different. I mean, going from Lola to Yoda is not going to be meaningful satire because the song Yoda had nothing to do with the underlying song of Lola. He was not making fun of Lola. He was not criticizing Lola. He was just making his song popular because it was to the tune of Lola. So that one would have been an infringement. But Weird Al is smart. He gets permission. And since he's cool and campy, the people with the underlying works tend to say, oh, people will actually go back and buy my album once they hear your knockoff of it. So yeah, let's go for it. Some say no. And he's smart enough to say, well, then I'll parody someone else's. Because parody can't just be using that tune to make yours more recognizable. It has to be talking about it. The Pretty Woman case is one. The kind of rap version of Pretty Woman was sampling some of it in there was counted as satire because it was making fun of and satiring the kind of innocent previous work. Okay, that's the law. Yeah.
One of the big challenges to getting permission is finding actually who in the big maze of corporate ownerships that all these copyrights tend to flow to, who the hell owns
possible.
It. Is there any effort underway to provide any kind of national registry of copyright so that you could actually look up who the hell owned the work that you want to use in your efforts?
Scott asked something similar just a few minutes ago, and I don't know if there is something underway. There could be that I don't know about. There is not one existing. There are different clearinghouses of sorts. I mean, the Library of Congress has all of your copyrights.
It's a legal thing.
Yeah, the government sort of has it, but it's a problem. We call them orphan copyrights, where the copyright says this person owns the copyright. Are they still alive? Are they dead? Do they still own it? We don't know. And that's a big problem.
Yeah, we've just started the process of digitizing all of our past records with the Copyright Office, mm-hmm. but we know it's going to take us 10 years because we have 91 million records.
So it ain't there yet.
It's not.
And eventually, yeah, the trademarks are searchable. They're ahead of you guys. The trademarks are searchable back to some of the really, really old ones. It's cool what you can find on there, but copyright,
that's
no.
That's easy as a service corporation, so in the corporate welfare state.
Trademarks are actually for your benefit, not for the companies. Yes?
Can you crack digital rights management in order to enact a fair use of a work, or does the DMCA override fair use?
DMCA overrides fair use. DMCA is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. I always can get the letters straight for kind of the village people in the back of my mind when I'm saying DMCA. I try not to do the song with it. But DMCA, in addition to some other things, provides that it's part of the Copyright Act. It provides that it is illegal to hack through digital rights management. So if there's some copy protection on a piece of software or on a piece of music, even though you can hack through it easily, you are violating a separate piece of law by hacking through so that you can copy the, we have a question, so that you can copy the underlying work. So even if the copying of the work would be a fair use and would be allowable, you're not allowed to hack the protection. That's a separate crime.
In most cases. The DMCA includes a clause where the Copyright Office can release. Every 3 years they release.
Yeah, they have
a list of
updated things.
Like notably, this year is when it was up, and they specifically added. They added a few exceptions.
Okay.
One, cell phones.
Yes.
Are legal. Apple was trying to say that it was illegal to jailbreak their cell phones.
Yeah.
So to run your legally acquired applications on their
people buying the Droids, not the iPhones.
And
as I understand it.
They were also claiming that it was illegal to jailbreak it to use it on another cell network.
So the library just released some exemptions. Good.
Yeah.
They said you can't jailbreak.
Specifically said that you can use it on any wireless network, on any cell network, and that you can defeat their DRM to use your legally acquired software.
Cool.
There are several other provisions that I'm not familiar with, but are several other exceptions.
Usually when I read those exceptions, I don't know what any of them mean, so I don't usually stick current on what exactly. I'm not a hacker. I have a phone that I use to talk.
Most of the exemptions actually apply to academic institutions and to libraries, which have some slightly different exemptions under the doctrine for sale.
Right.
Which we are allowed to have copies. We are allowed to jailbreak.
Yeah, you're allowed to do different things. Libraries get different rules.
Yeah, libraries have different rules, and we are allowed to hack it.
Sure.
For preservation purposes,
right.
For the purpose of sharing works that we've legally acquired under their doctrine for sale.
Yeah, and now a whole lot of that hasn't changed, but there's a new layer with Google's latest move to acquire the known universe. But yeah, librarians have different rules. I tend not to focus on the smaller exceptions, but yeah, y'all get completely different rules. And you know, there's something you said for, it's a library. You kind of want them to have all this stuff. So they get separate rules, teachers get separate rules, but again, the teachers are not as much, we don't get as good a rule as the librarians do, because there's a point where, especially if I'm copying someone's textbook to use in my class, well, I am their market. I shouldn't be copying their textbook. I did a presentation for a bunch of bishops at one point, and a lot of their chancellors, their lawyers, were very unhappy to learn that, yes, I know you're a church, but God doesn't trump Congress in this case. And just because you want to use those songs from that hymnal or from someone else's music book, just because you're only using them in your church, well, who the hell do you think the target audience for this religious music is? It's you. You're stealing. And it's not often you get to look at a room of bishops and say, quit stealing, and have them all look embarrassed. It's kind of fun. But they, I mean, since they were actually good people at heart, they were kind of stunned to realize that they had been stealing, because they think, oh, we're a church. We can use things freely. And you can put butter on your bird, and you can mail stuff to you. And you know, none of these things work. But they're like, oh. And they finally realize, well, I am the audience of this religious music. Oops.
There's a clearance, the clearinghouse for the license, and it's like $100 a year. You make as many copies as you want. They're really cool.
Yeah, there are some for certain narrow audiences. There's not a big one that I'm aware of. Yeah.
If you file a screenplay with the Writers Guild, you also need to copyright that?
Yes. Always copyright, that's your protection. Anytime you're working through a group, they're protecting themselves. Copyright it first, then do whatever it is, and at some point you're going to be yielding some of your rights, but first get your rights, then start giving them away. Now, again, copyright's attached to you just by virtue of having written it, but we're a creature of laws. Go ahead and use the protections of the law. But then go ahead and file, then, you know, derogate out your rights to whatever the Screen Actors Guild tell you you have to do, because, you know, we're people and they're the guild, so we do what they say.
And then if you write a screenplay based on someone else's idea, and no one
It depends. You wrote a screenplay based on someone else's idea.
Like a director brings an idea to you, you write a screenplay?
If all the director brought you was an idea, ideas are not protected, so the director has no rights. What you wrote down, your expression of that idea, is the copyrighted work, and you own the copyright to your expression of that idea. Ideas are not protected by copyright. The director who brought you that idea owns nothing, unless you signed a contract to the contrary. So watch what they give you to sign, because they're not asking you to sign. Anytime someone gives you something to sign, they're not doing it for your protection. Yeah.
Does the first sale doctrine have any application to ebooks, or is it more of a software paradigm?
First sale applies to all copyrights. Ebooks are, again, a creature of contract at that point. It's done through the publishers, and now it's like Google's changing the rules altogether. But how the ebooks work, when you are getting that ebook, you're going through, you're clicking some I agrees in there too. So the first sale doctrine is confined by whatever you've agreed to in contract. So whatever you've agreed to place stuff on your Kindle, and that's one that the market's kind of correcting. When those first came out, they were really, really restricted, and they've been getting more user-friendly as more competitors enter the market, and people say, oh, well, I can make money if I make the rights looser. I don't make money if I make it the way I want it to be all proprietary at the outset. So it's expanding and becoming more user-friendly over time. But that one, again, we've kind of subverted how the copyright law is working by virtue of having software just screwed things up. I'm sorry. I know most of y'all make your living with software, but it really screwed things up, because software is not inherently supposed to be covered by copyright, because the value of software is not in its expression. It's in the fact that it's a bunch of damn machine instructions. You're making a machine do something. It's part of the machine. It's really a gear. It's a digital gear.
The functional aspect, isn't that supposed to negate copyright?
In theory, there's an element of copyright if you have... When I teach the class, I have all sorts of really weird, kitschy crap that I bring in. I have some big giraffe slippers. And actually, I walk into the class wearing these big, funky giraffe slippers, and I wait to see how many students notice it. And what I have found is that since they're law students, some of them notice it, but they're afraid to say anything. Because some of them are fairly certain that I've just kind of lost it, and I don't know that I'm wearing big giraffe slippers, and they're afraid to tell me. So it's really kind of, I mess with my students, because they're law students, you kind of gotta. There was a point to this. the functional part of copyright. So in my funky giraffe slippers, the functional part of slipper, I can't own. The funky part of, and I bought them in Japan, so they sort of look like a hybrid of a giraffe and a dragon. I'm not sure what they are. They're really kind of cool. But so the funky design part is in theory protected by copyright. The functional keep your feet warm part is not. If I have a glass in the shape of a horse, hypothetically, I would never own such a thing. The holding water or liquor, and drinking out of it part is not protected. The form of the horse is, in theory. So when it comes to software, just like idea expression in a book, the functional aspect of the software is not supposed to be protectable, but both source code and object code are copyrightable. And when you're talking about machine-readable code, there's no expression. All that is instructions for a computer. It's a digital gear. And so you can't separate expression from function at that point.
Yeah, it's not authoring, it doesn't do it too. Documentation.
A sweat of the brow does not get you copyright. You own it because the government says you own it, not because you worked on it.
I didn't know somebody who wrote poetry in COBOL, but that's
that would be protectable. Poetry in COBOL, if it was the poetry and it didn't make the computer do something, then that would be absolute expression. That should be appropriately protected by copyright. But the actual, it makes a machine do something part is not supposed to be covered by copyright, but it is now. And that's where it just gets screwy, because you're not supposed to protect the function, but we are. And now if you shrink wrap it, you get these new contract rights rather than your copyrights. And if I can shrink wrap my software and distribute it to you under the terms of my shrink wrap license rather than under the terms of the copyright law, well, why can't I sell you that book that I swiped earlier in shrink wrap? Is there any reason I can't shrink wrap my book and license it to you rather than sell it to you? If you're going to allow contract law to swallow copyright law for software, you should be able to do it for everything else, and it's heading that direction.
I got a quick question.
I think we're over time, but we have time for one more.
You're being invaded. We're running into the next session.
Okay. How about you ask me afterwards? Because okay. I don't want to keep everyone behind schedule here.